The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe. You can find us at www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more, and we have been bringing you this podcast nearly every week for 3 years or so, which is a modern miracle of broadcasting. We do this on a shoestring budget and out of the goodness of our hearts and out of our passion for the subjects that we cover. And if you like the show, and I know you do, please drop us a line or leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our fine program. And we do have a fine program for you this week. It is quality movie season, and our chief film critic, Stephen Garrett, went to the Toronto International Film Festival and has a report about the really interesting sounding movies that he saw there. We're going to talk for a while about that coming up. And I'm also going to talk to Adam Hirschfelder about a not so quality movie, about a Ronald Reagan biopic that is playing in most theaters near you and does have some adherence among the kinds of people who love Ronald Reagan. And there are a lot of people who love Ronald Reagan, but the film itself does not match up to Reagan's life. But first, we are going to talk to contributor Greg Ford about season two of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, the fantasy series that is sort of like The Lord of the Rings, but not really. And Greg has a lot of pointed things to say about the problems with The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, and I'm going to agree with pretty much every one of them, and we'll be talking right after this interlude.
Sauron has returned in a new form.
He's in Eregion to craft rings that will allow him to dominate my kind and yours.
Leave Sauron to me.
There is a new season afoot on Amazon Prime of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, the Tolkien-themed prequel to The Lord of the Rings. Our resident J.R.R. Tolkien expert, Greg Ford, is here with me today to talk about the new season, and he has reviewed both seasons for us and even wrote a preview piece about The Rings of Power before it came out in 2022. This was a show that fans of The Lord of the Rings were, you know, excited about, but also wary of. And I think the second season proves that their skepticism was justified.
Well, it really just shows that buying the appendices to a book doesn't really give you a lot of material to work from, and that you're going to have to make up an awful lot, because that's what the producers did. They just bought the appendices to The Lord of the Rings, thinking that that would be enough to make a halfway decent Tolkien adaptation out of. And
it's a halfway decent show, as you point out. Like, if you're just looking for like a halfway decent fantasy saga, it definitely achieves that.
Yes, but if you're someone like me who even after a while started to see too many holes in Peter Jackson's adaptations, because, you know, I like Tolkien that much, and then this is really just not the show for you. It doesn't really have much to do with Tolkien. There are characters that don't belong. There are monsters that don't even belong, that couldn't have any place within Tolkien's world.
Right. Was it the Barrow-wite you pointed out?
Barrow-wites, yeah. Which those show up in a critical scene in the Fellowship of the Ring.
They're like the monsters, Sauron's like deputies. They ride horses and they're very scared.
No. Those are the Black Riders. The Barrow-wites are they're sort of underlings to the Nazgul, to the Black Riders. Ah. But they end up in the Fellowship of the Ring. They pose a grave threat to Frodo and the other hobbits, who are then freed by Tom Bombadil, who also shows up in that episode sort of incongruously.
Tom Bombadil, who is a character from the first Lord of the Rings book, who was very famously excised from the Peter Jackson adaptations. Given that his Ring saga was 10 hours long, there probably was room for a 10-minute Tom Bombadil scene, but they just thought he was too silly.
Well, too silly for one thing, and he doesn't quite further the plot. He furthers the section with Tom Bombadil in the book really mostly just shows you that Frodo is flawed. And that's about it. So, but there, we get plenty of other places in, you know, to figure that out.
Okay, but here's the thing about the Rings of Power, right? There are characters from the Lord of the Rings, like Galadriel and Elrond and Tom Bombadil and other, you know, Sauron, you know, these are names that you know, but the action takes place 1,000 years before the Lord of the Rings. So, okay, we know that people live a long, you know, creatures live a long time in Middle Earth. Nonetheless, I just feel like it's like almost like fan fiction.
It is like fan fiction. It's all rearranged in these strange ways, and you don't really understand the motivations of the characters. Things are just happening because things have to happen. We don't really get why Elrond is so dead set against the use of the rings that Galadriel and the other elves have. It doesn't make any sense. He just doesn't like them.
He just doesn't like, he finds them kind of unseemly, I guess. So, yeah, but here's the thing, like the show, I feel like it looks pretty good. Like it's an expensive show. The sets are elaborate. The photography is somewhat dark sometimes, but you know, there certainly is landscape. There's a sense of scope. But I find that narratively, it's actually kind of slow.
It takes a long time for things to get anywhere, which is very strange considering how compressed a season it is. I mean, it's what, only 8 episodes? I'm not even sure what's happened yet.
There's some rings. They put on some rings. That people walk around and, you know, get into fights. You know, and that's the thing is the first season is like a 20-minute sort of character origin for Sauron, who we've already met, but they give us a little extra backstory, which they could have given us last season, but we have to sit through it this season. I mean, it's well done as such things are, but it doesn't serve any narrative purpose. And that's the whole thing about this show is like, it doesn't serve any narrative purpose. You're not caught up, you know, the Peter Jackson movies, you may think they're flawed, but they have a narrative scope and a force behind them. You know, there's a drive and they're highly emotional and funny in places as well. And this has none of those things.
No, actually, the lack of humor is remarkable, even with the proto-hobbits, let's call them, in this show.
The Harfoots.
The Harfoots, the Stoors, or whatever you want to call them. There are some little attempts at humor, it seems like, but nothing lands. I mean, the first season did a really bad job with the dwarves and made them look ridiculous all the time. And maybe that was supposed to be funny, but it just was just embarrassing.
But I think part of the problem there, Greg, is that it's because of a lack of character development. You know, it's like because the characters are so thinly defined, it's hard to find anything that they're doing funny or dramatic.
Yeah, that's about right. They are just driven around by, I don't know, somebody's ideas of how to get from history point A in Tolkien's appendices to history point B to C, ultimately to Sauron forging the One Ring and then all sorts of bad stuff happening.
Well, I think the real problem here is that you have the Lord of the Rings, the world of Tolkien, has now fallen prey to the universing of culture, right? So like, it's, you know, the Star Wars universe is bloated well beyond what we knew as children. I guess the Star Trek universe was always kind of large because it literally takes place in the universe. But you look at other culture, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe or other large cultural entities, you know, they have grown sort of beyond what they were meant to be in some ways. And so, you know, like with Tolkien, right, there's an animated, an anime film coming out this fall that's sort of based on the sort of world of Tolkien. There's a Gollum origin story movie.
That one sounds particularly perturbing. I just can't imagine.
We've already seen Gollum's origin story. We know. How much more do you need?
It takes up about half a chapter in The Fellowship of the Ring. That's not really... As for the animated film that's coming up, that might be halfway decent because that is an actual story from Tolkien that they're basing it on.
I saw a preview for it. It actually looked fairly exciting and it looked like it had some, you know, some narrative thrust to it. But that's the thing. It's like not everything that comes out in these universes is bad. It's just that there's a lot, you know, there's just a lot. And the Rings of Power is, I just don't like it. I don't like watching it.
No, it's kind of painful. I gave up after the 3 episodes that I watched for the review. I've been reading recaps just because I'm kind of curious to see where it goes, but I'm not going to watch any more of it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I can. I just don't think I can. I was looking at my phone half the time, and I try to be a person who still watches things.
They should have bought the rights to the Silmarillion, which is the same story, but they actually would have had plot to work with instead of just a list of events.
But it is, and it is, so it is the same story.
Essentially, yeah.
All right. Well, I guess that's too late now. And now we have the Rings of Power. And I don't know how many. I mean, given the slowness of the journey that the character's on, I guess this could be on for 1,000 years.
God forbid.
All right, Greg Ford, thank you so much. The Rings of Power season 2 is airing on Amazon. It's quality movie season. We have endured the summer blockbuster season, and now we're on to Oscar-contending movies. The film festival season has begun. We're just concluding the Telluride Film Festival, the Venice Film Festival, and the Toronto International Film Festival, which Stephen Garrett attended.
Hello.
Hello, Stephen. On his own behalf and on behalf of Book and Film Globe, he saw many, many movies, and he's here to tell me about what is coming to a quality cinema near you. So, Stephen, what did you said there was lots of good stuff at Toronto this year. What were some of the highlights?
Yeah, it was pretty good. Well, okay, so part of the reason Toronto is as good as it is because it picks the best movies from all the other good festivals. So if you can't make it to Berlin or Cannes or Venice or Telluride, chances are you will see the bulk of the movies you need to see at Toronto. So it's like the Walmart or the Costco of movie festivals.
Or the Tim Hortons. The Tim Hortons.
It's the Tims. Yeah, it's the Tim Hortons. It's very useful. It's very useful. So they have a lot of good stuff. Now, can I claim that it's Toronto's, you know, amazing curation that does it? No, they're picking the obvious stuff. And the couple world premieres that the festival had were not so amazing, but they weren't bad. But yeah, no, for the most part, there's some quality stuff coming at us.
So what, like what?
Oh, okay. Well, let's get into it. Okay. Yeah. So, the stuff that I talked about, there'll be a second article. In the first article that I wrote about, I kind of focused on the big flash and sizzle story out of the festival, which was that Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig give very, very sexy, sexy performances in 2 respective movies. The first being Baby Girl, which Nicole Kidman was in, and she won Best Actress at Venice, which is where it premiered. And it is a very steamy, kind of sassy, ridiculous, but also heartfelt movie about, well, it's definitely a master-servant sort of dynamic, older woman, younger man, but the younger man is very much in control. And the older woman is a CEO. She's Nicole Kidman, and she hates herself for loving it. And it comes together in a pretty hilarious way. And so the movie does have a nice sense of humor about itself. It's directed by this woman, written and directed by this woman, Helena Rain, who did Bodies, Bodies, Bodies a few years ago. So she loves being provocative, but this really, I mean, this has got Nicole Kidman on all fours. You know, this has got Nicole Kidman getting pleasured repeatedly by this younger man and also by Antonio Banderas, who is the husband who is a little confused by his wife's strange sexual behavior. It's a juicy movie. It's kind of a bit of a mess, but that's part of the point. A24 is coming out with it later in the year.
Is it twisty? Like, I love bodies. Is it twisty like that?
It's kind of twisty like that. I mean, it has some preposterous things. You kind of have to buy into the idea that she would allow herself to be seduced by this guy. And also, like, the character says at one point, well, you know, I was raised in cults and communes, as though that's a sort of get out of jail free card for explaining aberrant behavior as an adult, you know. But still, it's fun to go with it. Her performance is fantastic. It's a good time.
Baby girl, Nicole Kidman on all fours. I'll buy my ticket
exactly
now.
Exactly.
All right. Yeah. So meanwhile, you've got Daniel Craig. You referred to him in your review. A phrase that I actually had. I actually had to take it out as a cock gobbler.
In one scene.
I would hope I hope it's on every scene, because that would be porn.
No, this was a really, the thing is, Luca Guadagnino, who gave us things like Call Me By Your Name and Challengers earlier in this year.
Movie's called Queer, by the way.
This movie is straight up queer, based on William S. Burroughs' novel, which was written in the early 1950s, didn't come out until 1985. And I've read that it's because Burroughs was a little anxious about it, couldn't bear to look at it himself because it was so candid and it was so raw and confessional. And that comes across in the movie. And Daniel Craig is amazing in this performance, where he really gives it all. It's just an emotional performance as it is a physical performance. And he commits physically pretty impressively. And it is him as a middle-aged man it's an older man, younger man dynamic, the way that Baby Girl is, older, younger. And it's very much about mortality. It's very much about fear of being alone, fear of death, you know, what is the meaning of my life, but it's wonderfully done and it's incredibly tender and it's incredibly raw. So hats off. It's a superior film. It's one of the best films of the year for sure.
All right. Yeah. Sounds like a sure awards contender. All right. Those are sort of the highlights from the first piece. So I was prepared for that. What else have you consumed?
Well, just a very quick recap too. I think the best film I saw was this movie called The Brutalist, which is about 3.5 hours long, by Brady Corbett, with Adrian Brody as a brutalist architect who comes from Hungary. He's an immigrant. It's about the immigrant experience and also capitalism and also art and commerce and big ideas. And it's fantastic. I really did not think this movie was going to fly by as quickly as it did. And when the intermission came, because there is an intermission, and it's earned and it's fantastic. I mean, this really is. It's like the architect's version of There Will Be Blood. You know, it's just absolutely gripping from beginning to end.
All right.
So I would say that's great. Also, The Room Next Door has amazing performances. That's Pedro Almodóvar. Pedro Almodóvar's new film about Tilda Swinton plays a woman who's dying of cancer, and Julianne Moore is her old friend who she hasn't seen in a long time, who kind of helps midwife the euthanasia process, so to speak. Incredible performances for both of them.
It doesn't sound like a lot of fun, but we know. But if it's Almodóvar, it must be visually beautiful and, you know, well scripted, well paced, and all that. So all right, so these are movies that are need to find distribution, right? These are films that will be in theaters this fall.
These will be in theaters, yes. A24 has Baby Girl. They picked up The Brutalist for like $10 million or something during Toronto. And The Room Next Door is Sony Classic, so that'll be coming out towards the end of the year. So all these are guaranteed to come out. Now I'll get to some movies I hadn't talked about in the first article. I am talking in the second article. Conclave is hilarious. I mean, it is, somebody called it Pope fiction, because it's pulpy and ridiculous and kind of fun if you dig that kind of thing. And it is fun, but it's absolutely absurd. It's basically the Pope dies and there is heated, you know, political backstabbing over who will become the next Pope. And it stars Stanley Tucci and Ralph Fiennes and John Lithgow and all sorts of people. Directed by Edward Berger, who did All Quiet on the Western Front, the German film that came out a couple of years ago that, you know, was in the mix for tons of awards and won a lot of BAFTAs.
That was a very well done and depressing Oscar nominee.
I suppose so. I didn't quite like it as well. I mean, you know, it's like remaking Gone with the Wind in certain circles. But, you know, All Quiet on the Western Front is one of the classic, you know, movies made in the 1920s.
Early Oscar winner. Anyway, so the guy who made that, made Conclave.
Made Conclave, which is absolutely, talk about, you were talking earlier about like good twists and turns. This has ridiculous twists and turns, but it is juicy and fun. At one point, Stanley Tucci says, you know, if that's true, that will make me the Richard Nixon of popes.
Of course.
So it's absurd. It's patently absurd. There's another film called The Order, which is about white supremacists in 1970s. Where is it? Is it Montana? It's out kind of Midwest. And it is gripping and wonderful. It's by a guy named Justin Kurzel, who's this. He's made a ton of great movies. Australian guy, usually dealing with toxic masculinity. And this stars Jude Law as the FBI hunter who's trying to track down all the white supremacists. And it is fantastic and based on a real story.
Okay.
All you know, real stuff. That is fantastic. But the craziest things I saw, they're kind of gimmicky biopics. Let me just categorize them as that. The first is one that Paramount is putting out called Piece by Piece, which is Morgan Neville's documentary about Pharrell Williams. But the whole thing is done in Lego. So it's a Lego documentary, and it is ridiculous and hilarious. And every time there's a new person interviewed on camera, they're played by a Lego. So it's like a Lego version of Jay-Z or a Lego version of Gwen Stefani. And the needle drops are incredible and fun. And it's all like the greatest pop and rap songs you've heard, hip hop songs that of the past 25 years, because he had his finger in most of them, you know, as producer.
And it's all done in Legos.
And it's all done in Lego. They even recreate some of the music videos. So like Snoop Dogg's, you know, Drop It Like It's Hot, you know, redone in Lego. It's ridiculous. All right. So that's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
All right.
There's another one that's crazy called Better Man by Michael Gracie. He's the director of The Greatest Showman. And that was a surprise hit that nobody thought would do any business, but everybody loved it, you know, with the P.T.
Yeah,
with
Hugh, yes, the Barnum musical starring Hugh Jackman. I know
Hugh Jackman.
I'm very familiar with that film. Yes.
Okay, so are you familiar with you probably are, because you have an incredible knowledge for so many things. Robbie Williams, does that ring a bell?
The British pop star of the '90s, who often performed shirtless,
and who started in what?
I don't remember.
He was in a boy band called Take That.
Okay.
Great boy band from the early 90s. Anyway, so it's kind of like he's the Justin Timberlake of, you know, Liverpool, but like, you know.
Of the UK.
Of the UK. Anyway, so Robbie Williams, this is a Robbie Williams biopic, right? Oh, I'm sorry. I said Piece by Piece is Paramount. Better Man is Paramount. That's the Robbie Williams biopic. Piece by Piece is Universal. So these are big major studios doing these big, expensive, splashy musical biopics, right?
Right. So it's a Robbie Williams biopic, but what makes it crazy?
And it's not a documentary. It's more like Rocket Man. Okay, here is the deal. You ready? Robbie Williams, whose character is named Robbie Williams, is played by a monkey the entire thing. It's live action. So imagine Caesar from Planet of the Apes, from the new Planet of the Apes movies.
Yeah.
Becoming, joining a boy band and then spinning off and then just hanging out with Oasis and becoming a solo artist and like, you know.
So it's like a CGI, like it's a CGI monkey?
It's a CGI monkey for 2.5 hours. And I like, after 5 minutes, I was like, I'm in. I'm totally in. I'm digging this. This works. Because he's a cheeky monkey, right? You know, he's a real laddie. And he's, you know, he's a wanker, as he says. And he's a bit of an ape. He's kind of a simian. Like, you look at him in real life, that's what Robbie Williams looks like. You know,
Robbie Williams signed off on this creative choice.
It's totally. I think it might be even his voice. It's certainly all of his songs through the whole thing. And it is absolutely, he totally signed off on it. And it's hilarious. And it works. And it's so entertaining. And it's ridiculous. It's completely authorized, so it's completely whitewashed, and it's the whole like, oh, you know, pity the poor pop star who has fame and fortune and is still unhappy. So it's like Elton John's, you know, in Rocket Man, where it's like he was miserable while all the happy things were happening around him, all the things he wanted.
Rocket Man, which in itself was moderately experimental and pretty good.
This is, yeah, this is experimental too, in that Robbie Williams is a monkey through the whole thing. And nobody comments on it. Everybody's like, yeah, no, you're Robbie Williams, you're a monkey. You know,
like a chimpanzee or a monkey.
Okay. I don't know. What was Caesar? Was he an ape? Was he a chimpanzee?
Caesar was a chimpanzee.
Okay. So let's say chimpanzee.
Monkeys tend to be pretty small.
Oh, that, well, he's full size. He's a full grown ass man. I mean, monkey.
He's a primate. There's a difference. Look, Stephen, like you said, I know a lot about a lot of things.
True.
Monkeys are primates, but chimpanzees are also primates. They're just they're a different branch of the primate tree. So let's say he's a chimpanzee. If we're both wrong, then we're going to get a lot of angry letters from
true. That's fair.
From all the primatologists.
I respect them. Listen
to the show. Well, I'll say this, and we have to cut this short here. This sounds like a good crop of films. I honestly would and will see every single one of the movies you just talked about.
Yeah, and I think you would do it with a relish. They're a lot of fun. There are a few more too that I'll mention, but you know, hey, read the article.
Look, I could talk to you about movies for an hour every day, and sometimes it feels like I do, but we got to cut it short. We got to cut it short. Stephen, thank you for your sacrifice and your time. And,
my pleasure to watch all these movies.
Yes, yes. Please keep going to the movies because they're still making them, apparently, and apparently they're still good. I'll talk to you soon.
Welcome to your life.
You can run from a bully for so long, but after a while, you're going to have to stand up to him.
What did the president know, and when did he know it?
I am about to start the biggest war of this century.
You told me you wanted to make a difference in this world.
What would you have me do?
I want you to fight!
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall!
It is political season here in the United States of America. And there is a political movie available for some people to watch. It's a biopic of Ronald Reagan. I'm kind of surprised, honestly, that there hasn't been a Reagan movie. I mean, Reagan has appeared as a character in movies here or there, but there hasn't been a Reagan movie. We've had JFK movie. We've had several JFK movies. There's a lot of Nixon movies. We have had a George W. Bush movie, but no Reagan movie. But Reagan is here, and it looks hilarious. Hilariously bad on accident, and our correspondent, our brave correspondent Adam Hirschfelder has seen Reagan and is here to talk to me about it. Hello.
Hello, Neil.
I know what a lover of Ronald Reagan you are. So really, Liz could not have chosen a better reviewer, you know. But the thing that's interesting about you, Adam, is I know you're a committed pinko, old school liberal, but you have a taste for this kind of thing.
I do, you know. I'm the liberal who didn't go, you know, way too far left, and I got to admit, you know, now I'm a Californian. I mean, when I was out, you know, protesting Reagan, I was an East Coast guy and all the rest back in the 80s and early 90s. But when I saw, you know, now as a Californian, I have a proper amount of respect, of course, my former governor. And when I saw this movie was coming, I oddly felt interested, excited, and looking forward to it. And I was like, you know, I really felt this would be a great time for this movie. And maybe this kind of recontextualization of Reagan, and especially as his party kind of, you know, moves in different directions. Like, this was the time for an important, interesting movie on Reagan. This was not it.
I haven't seen it, right? But I have seen the trailer for that. It just looks like a satire of a Ronald Reagan movie, that like something that would have been cooked up on like a 90s late night sketch TV show during the Ronald Reagan era.
Yeah, it's exactly it. I was watching it. It was like, you know, people. It's like a mixture of like Saturday Night Live with the Heritage Foundation of the time then. Some mashup between like, yeah, Saturday Night Live, some sketch comedy. Like, you can't be serious. Like now, literally, in 2024.
The thing that really grabbed me in the trailer, right, is that, you know, Ronald Reagan delivers his Mr. Gorbachev tear down that wall speech, and then they cuts to Margaret Thatcher in her office saying, what does she say, like, go get him, cowboy, or win?
Good, great job, cowboy.
Right. Is that historically accurate?
I mean, I'm not sure we know about that, but she did refer to him as a cowboy at some times, and that's been part of her kind of the Thatcher-Reagan relationship stuff, so it was taken from that. But, you know, there's an important point, obviously, to be said about the Cold War. But to use that as the, you know, sole and only framing, and that's what this is. Like, the movie needed a tagline, Reagan and the Cold War, or Reagan and something else, or God and Country, or something. But to have the whole thing framed, not only from the Cold War, but then, you know, the story is told from the eyes and viewpoint of this kind of washed up KGB agent who explains to this up and coming kind of like Gen Y millennial, like KGB wannabe, like who comes in and says, you know, explain to me how it is that, you know, our country lost to America. It doesn't make sense to me. And the whole thing is like described by the, you know, John Voight's character who plays this like washed up Russian with this weird accent, like... The whole thing is.
And so that's the narrative frame. That's not in the trailer. That's the narrative framework that it's narrated. Yes. And the story is being told. Ronald Reagan's life story told by a KGB agent.
By a KGB agent and how they lost. Like, you know, you could, like, really, like, it just, it, you know, and you can see so many people responding to it, although the small number of conservative reviewers who love it. And of course, you know, the Reaganites and all the people who love him or still claim to love him, you know, going to this thing in droves, and it's doing a bit better than, you know, folks expected. Not a terrible surprise, but to add anything to the understanding of Reagan, which, you know, obviously movies can do, a mainstream movie. Look, every movie, documentary, whatever is going to be sappy or have its own viewpoint. But this thing is so over the top. I mean, you couldn't come up with anything this silly. Saturday Night Live couldn't come up with something this silly.
And here's the thing, like, you can love Ronald Reagan. You can believe that he was the greatest president ever. And there are, I know people who believe that Ronald Reagan was the greatest president we ever had. Like, he's up there with George Washington and Abraham Lincoln in the eyes of some people. Yes. That's different, though, than the aesthetics of a film.
Yeah,
right.
Right. And the cheesiness of it comes through. It's funny. I was just even catching up on some more reviews today, even in some Catholic newspapers say, yeah, you know, it's kind of good. But even the, you know, the cheesiness takes away from the serious element. Like, even folks would agree with it. It's so cheesy, so silly. Like, you just wonder, you know, what the hell was the point?
Well, it looked to me from the trailer like there is some sort of young Reagan in Hollywood. Stuff.
Yes. And it goes through his whole life from Dixon, Illinois onwards. And we get him, you know, as a B movie actor. And then the kind of, you know, his career kind of doesn't take off in Hollywood in full, you know, a full Hollywood star. He was B list and all the rest. And then he turns to ads and has him as a kind of a pitch man for cigarettes. I think it touches upon his time as a GE pitch man, but doesn't really go into how that was such a significant role in his life as he traveled the country pitching GE, you know, military contractor companies' wares, and how that helped him grow his base and understanding of America, at least from his standpoint.
What percentage of the film is the actual Reagan presidency? It's got to be at least half, right?
Yeah, I'd say about 40%. But you go through his whole life. And then you have 40% as his two administrations.
How is a KGB agent going to know about Reagan's boyhood in Dixon, Illinois?
Exactly. How
would you know? Or his time in Hollywood. He's not going to know
about the boyhood. And then there's this kind of, you know, this kind of lurches towards, you know, Reagan was for this virile masculine, you know, we knew about him being a football player. At least I vaguely knew about his football player. He was that lifeguard and, you know, that prepared him for Hollywood. And then Voight's KGB character, you know, supposedly picked up on, you know, that Reagan was going to be the crusader who would take down the Soviet Union when he was fighting as the president of the Screen Actors Guild. And that's when the smart people in the Soviet Union knew Reagan would be the one. So that's where it picks up. Mm-hmm. But yeah, how did he know the first one?
That's when they knew that they were really paying attention to that, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So a few things I wanted to touch on. Dennis Quaid plays Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Is he all right?
Yeah, he does okay. You know, it's interesting because he plays some of Reagan earlier in his life, and there's a huge age discrepancy for how old, you know, Quaid is versus when Reagan is, you know, in his kind of early days and when he's with the Screen Actors Guild. I mean, it's a 20, 30, 40 year difference.
Yeah.
I thought Quaid was watchable. I mean, he's a very watchable actor.
I mean, it's not the casting that's the problem. The other thing I was curious about was the treatment of the Iran-Contra scandal.
Yes.
Was the blackest mark, a black mark on American history, and perhaps the blackest mark on the Reagan presidency.
Certainly. And it gets touched upon, you know, and I was wondering if they could even like go into it. And it certainly touches upon it. And I thought that's one reason I was kind of looking forward to this movie, especially with the role of Iran being in the current events. Like, how are they going to touch upon it? But again, the framing of this thing, you know, it hurts his popularity. That's touched upon. And then there's this like, Reagan, you just got to go out and tell the truth. And it really focuses on his second speech to Americans, I believe late in 87, where he tells people, hey, I made a mistake. This actually did happen in my administration, as much as I didn't want to believe it. And there's that speech to the public. And then he's in also in a cabinet meeting briefly. And this 5 or 6 minute kind of camera stare at William Casey, the CIA director, where it's clear, you know, the directors and all this stuff are parking Iran-Contra at the feet of Bill Casey, you know, obviously dies, you know, just as public hearings are going to begin on it, which where Oliver North becomes this incredibly famous person, or at least a character at that time. And it's clear they just kind of park it at the feet of William Casey, ill-serving Reagan.
Right. That's like saying that Watergate was the fault of J. Edgar Hoover.
Right. Someone else's fault. And yeah. But in this, it positions that Reagan, you know, takes responsibility.
It's like Donald Trump saying he had nothing to do with January 6th. Or if Adam McKay's W movie had somehow, Dick Cheney movie had somehow like shunted the blame for the invasion of Iraq on you know, someone else. I mean, I understand that this is meant to be a hagiography of Ronald Reagan, but I just feel like a good movie would present something like this with some nuance.
Yes, and I gotta say, I'd like to go back to it without paying for it somehow, because I want to see the camera angle as it focuses on William Casey. And does he smile?
You saw it in a movie. He doesn't smile. You saw it in a movie theater.
I saw it in a movie theater, and I was really taken by the 5 or 6 seconds it just focuses on Bill Casey. And you could tell what they're trying to do, but I'd like to see that visual again. You know, of course, not only parking at Bill Casey, but parking at Bill Casey, the guy who dies and never says a word about it. You know, certainly
all his fault. Reagan had nothing to do with Iran-Contra, and I'm guessing that it doesn't really touch on his treatment of the AIDS epidemic either.
Well, it does very briefly, you know, uh-huh. And that's one of the big things. I mean, look, there were a lot of detractors from Reagan. Some had a point, some didn't, and some were crazy, but whatever. So there's this brief moment where they summarize all the Reagan's detractor in this like 30-second MTV movie clip, and I think it's a shout-out to MTV and the Times, of listening to Genesis, Land of Confusion, you know, a video that originally, you know, kind of mocked Reagan, and certainly from the beginning of the video, you can go back and look at that. And for 30 seconds, you see, let's act up, an AIDS activist protesting in like on a video in a film. So they're not in real life. They're in a video. So they're like the other. They're really outside of it. They're the freaks, you know, much like the freaks that Reagan ran against, or he did literally ran against and spoke against at the University of California, Berkeley during the 60s when he was the California governor in his race for governor. Like anyone who protested against this guy was either a freak, naive, stupid, you know, or kind of
a hippie,
a loser hippie. And it's just like long past time, I think, to kind of, you know, again, to try to take this a little more seriously, or at least try.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, if you've read Rick Perlstein's book on the Reagan era, you know, you know that, you know, I mean, I would say Rick Perlstein is sort of an anti-Reagan voice, but it presents the era of Ronald Reagan Republicanism with some nuance.
Certainly some, the nuance, the history of it all. And that's obviously, look, it's going to be hard.
And we lived through it. We lived through it. And I'm fascinated to read, because I was a kid, you know, I didn't know what the hell was actually going on. I was just hanging out at the mall. But, you know, to read about that era now in retrospect as history is extremely interesting. And I want nuance. I don't want, you know, if we're able to present Dr. Martin Luther King with nuance in film, we should be able to give some nuance to Ronald Reagan.
I fully 100% agree. And I really, you know, I was eager, right? I've gone back and now to read about those times. How did we get here today from then? You know, you wanted to fill in some blanks or at least engage some of the process, some historical thinking. And this thing did none of it. It was like 1984 all over. I mean, it was like 1984 all over again. Like, you know, really?
Literally. All right. One last question before I let you go. Does the film meaningfully engage with Nancy Reagan's appearance on Different Strokes?
What you talking about, Mr. Pollack?
I guess the answer is no. All right, Adam Hirsch. No, that's too bad. That was the most important moment, one of the most important moments in American history. Reagan does not have the courage to address it. And Reagan is, I guess it's in theaters somewhere. If you want to see it, and you know, I'm sure it will be available in the archives of the Heritage Foundation.
or one of them, or AEI or Cato or something, but it's doing well. You know, hey, look, the people are going to see it.
I know Republicans need movies too.
Need movies too, but I hope they don't buy this totally hook, line, and sinker.
All right. Thank you so much, Adam.
Okay, Neil.
All right. Thank you so much, Adam Hirschfelder. Reagan, starring Dennis Quaid as Ronald Reagan and John Voight as a mysterious KGB agent defector, is playing in theaters now, mostly in theaters near you, and will be on streaming at some point as well. Also, thanks to Stephen Garrett for visiting Toronto and attending the Toronto Film Festival and giving us a preview of what's coming in multiplexes, or at least in your local art house this fall. And thanks to Greg Ford for enduring season 2 of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, a sort of Lord of the Rings-like show that is airing on Amazon Prime. I am Neil Pollack. I am your host. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV, where we talk about something every week. And that is the magic of this show, is that we talk and you listen. And I thank you so much for tuning in to this fine program. And I will talk at you soon.
Original production.